Wayne Wang's first film, Chan is Missing, was set in San Francisco's Chinatown, where one cook wore a Samurai Night Fever t-shirt and sang Fry Me to the Moon. That set the tone for Wang's films about the clash between traditional Chinese culture and American popular culture, and the conflicts between Chinese parents and their hipster American-born children. Wang is the most popular Chinese-American director in film history. Chan is Missing was a super low-budget independent production. It was an offbeat comedy set in San Francisco's Chinatown, and it got critical raves and was an arthouse success. His next film, Dim Sum, looked at the generational conflicts in one Chinese-American family. Slam Dance, his one film without a Chinese-American theme, was a stylish new wave thriller. The San Francisco-based director has a new film called Eat a Bowl of Tea. It stars his wife, Cora Miao, who is a film star in Hong Kong. It's set in New York's Chinatown in 1949 and is about an American-born young man who's sent to China by his father to find a wife. When the couple returns to Chinatown, the man's father begins to meddle in the newlywed's most intimate affairs. In this scene, the father, not so subtly, brings up the issue of having children by pointing at his crotch.
You don't know what to do with this. It's for making babies, not just to have fun with. Your mother cries every day.
Dad, I don't think we should discuss this.
I am your father.
I don't think it's any of your business.
I'm not pressuring you, just asking. If you don't feel like having children when you're young, when are you going to have them?
We'll have it when we feel like it.
We'll feel like it now!
This is your first movie that's not set in the present. What led you back? It's not that far back. It's 1949. But what led you to do a story set then?
Well, basically, I read this book when I was still in college called Eat a Bowl of Tea. And the book is actually set in 1949, and it's a very important point for important time actually for the Chinese in America, because previous to that time, since the 20s, there was this exclusion law where Chinese women couldn't come into this country unless you were a very rich businessman or whatever. And after 1945, some of the younger kids that fought in the U.S. Army was able to use the GI Bill to marry in China and bring their wives over. And I think that's a very important sort of context about the book and something that the American, don't know very little about. I think probably 90% of Americans here in this country don't know that there was this law. So that's why I kind of went back to 1949. It's the first period film I've done.
Mm-hmm. And it's set in a time when Chinatown was a kind of bachelor society because men couldn't bring their wives or their brides over. But another subject of your new movie is parental meddling, about how the older generation gets a little too intimately involved in the affairs of young couples. Was this a subject that rang true to you from your family experiences?
Pretty much. Actually, we've been married for 6 years and we've got the same kind of pressure, maybe not as direct as in the movie with the father going, "Do you know what to do with this?"
Right.
But my parents do it more subtly. Every time we go back for dinner, they'll go, "Well, so-and-so's been married for 6 years also, and they've got a kid 5 years old now." So we get it. And it's very, I think it's something that's not only Chinese, but I think it's pretty true with probably a lot of families in the 1980s.
Now, I understand when you got married that you actually didn't tell your parents right away. They read about it in the newspaper.
Oh, right. That's true. Actually, I'm not very good at telling my parents about my personal things. I've always sort of had a problem with that. So when I got married, Cora and I, wanted to be really our own thing, our own matter, so we really didn't tell anybody. And actually, for some reason, the Hong Kong gossip papers got a hold of it and printed it, and all of a sudden I get this phone call from my dad, and he goes, "Don't you have something you have to tell me?"
My guest is film director Wayne Wang, and his new movie is called Eat a Bowl of Tea. Now, I always assume, just having seen your movies but not knowing much about you, that I assumed that your parents were Chinese immigrants to America, and that you were born in America, because all of your movies all of your Chinese movies were about the differences between Chinese immigrants and their American-born children. But actually, you grew up in Hong Kong. Your parents fled China during the revolution, and I guess it was 1949 that they came to Hong Kong. Your mother was pregnant with you at the time when they arrived. So really, you grew up in Hong Kong. Do the generational differences that you address in your movies apply to what you experienced when you were growing up in Hong Kong?
I think so. They're probably very similar, only because my parents were very, very westernized and very Americanized, especially my dad. I think on one hand, he's also very traditionally Chinese. On the other hand, because he worked with the U.S. Navy base in China, he saw a lot of American movies, and he had a lot of American friends and always wanted us to be American, so to speak. So I sort of grew up with this very weird shading of being kind of Chinese from Hong Kong and yet at the same time very Americanized because of my dad's interests. And at the same time also very British because Hong Kong is a British colony.
So you grew up in an amalgam of cultures.
Yeah. And I also went to a Jesuit high school, which is another element in there, too. But I think also after I came to San Francisco and I was going to school and working there, I kind of, you know, got to really understand, you know, the ABCs, the American-born Chinese here, too. And sort of saw all those different sides of what it means to be Chinese in Hong Kong and China and, you know, somebody who's an immigrant here or somebody who was born here.
Well, I find it very interesting that you were really among the first Chinese Americans to explore the generational conflicts of Chinese Americans, yet you were from a different background. I'm wondering if you think that you were able to see things that people living in America didn't see about themselves.
Well, that might be true. I really don't know. I mean, for myself, I think just because I'm not involved myself, it gives me a little distance to look at everything. And perhaps also look at everything with a little bit more humor rather than, you know, take it so seriously or take it so dramatically.
Why did you come to the United States?
I basically, because of my dad's influence, I really, really wanted to be American in a lot of ways. I remember growing up in the 60s with a lot of the Rock Hudson Doris Day comedies, and that's sort of, you know, my image of what a family and what a life should be, actually. And I remember, you know, loving Jan and Dean and the Beach Boys, and I didn't even know what surfing was. The music was so powerful. Things like that were just sort of very much part of me. I mean, you know, American, but living and growing up in Hong Kong.
Is it true that your father named you after John Wayne?
Yeah, but it's actually a longer, more interesting story in that, you know, when my father was born, in his days, they would take the baby to a fortune teller, and the fortune teller would name the baby. And the fortune teller looked at my father and said, well, this baby is not going to have enough wood in his life, which is a key element in Chinese philosophy. So in a very poetic way, he named my father King of the Forest in Chinese. And then when my older brother was born, and him being the firstborn, was also poetically named in Chinese Prince of the Forest. Then when I came along, my dad by that time was so infatuated by John Wayne that he gave me an American name first. So I was named after John Wayne, and my Chinese name was derived from Wayne.
So when you came to America, you came first to study at college, but you ended up, did you end up living in Chinatown?
No, I didn't. Actually, I first went to school over in Berkeley, so I was living pretty much over there. And it wasn't until after I graduated from college, I made a graduate film, and I felt that I really hadn't been outside of the academic world, that I hadn't really worked in the world outside. So then I took a job in Chinatown working with immigrants from all over Asia.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I started actually also living in Chinatown, closer to Chinatown.
So here you were, a Chinese-American from Hong Kong in America, working in Chinatown. Were there parts of Chinese-American culture that you really emulated?
Yeah, I went through this sort of huge cycle. When I first came, I tried to be as American as I could and then basically become just completely white bread. And then after a while, when I started working back in Chinatown, I wanted to find my own Chinese roots. And yet at the same time, what was sort of interesting about that, I didn't want to just find the so-called, you know, traditional Chinese roots. And I found what was very exciting was kind of a very street Chinese-American quality, which is sort of actually represented by the younger kid in Chan Is Missing. There's something about the Chinese growing up in Chinatown, having a very street mentality and a street language, it's very influenced by the black. So that was something that I kind of emulated, actually, late 60s, early 70s.
You emulated that yourself?
Yeah. I mean, you know, sort of like talking black and, you know, listening to Smokey Robinson. I mean, it's like all that sort of really black jive sort of quality.
Well, you once said you went overboard in becoming Chinese during a period of your early life in America. What happened during that period?
Well, there was a period where I felt that I knew nothing about my own roots, that I didn't know enough about my own culture, literature, music, whatever. And I went overboard the other way, which is kind of just to, you know, just learn that, know about that, study that, and read about that. And for a while, I kind of become isolated that way. So swung to that other extreme of just being very Chinese and very defensively Chinese that way, too. And it wasn't until later that kind of I saw, you know, you can't just swing from one end to another end, you know, from white bread American to totally, you know, Chinese. There's something has to be sort of somewhere in the middle.
Is that what you feel you are now?
I feel like it's, I don't sort of think about it anymore. I kind of know that there will be conflicts in there between the two cultures in me. And yet at the same time, I can kind of can draw from the best of the two cultures too. And I'm pretty comfortable with sort of just letting that conflict be.
Before you made Chan Is Missing, did you try to work your way up in Hollywood? You know, try to like break into a major motion picture and get started there.
No, because I didn't think I would stand a chance. I mean, basically, I hadn't made any really significant films, and I would, you know, probably have no chance, you know, talking to the studios about doing anything. So I decided that I was going to work in TV and use TV to give me experience and maybe work in mainstream TV a little bit more. That was perhaps a little bit easier. And at the same time, you know, make a film that could give me some kind of credibility before I could do that.
And that was Chan Is Missing?
And that was Chan Is Missing.
So what was the genesis of the story in Chan Is Missing?
Pretty much the genesis was while I was working in Chinatown, the story of Chan came up so often. I remember at probably every other staff meeting, we would talk about some of the people that we were working with, which were all new immigrants. And all of a sudden, they would have, you know, similar kinds of problems to what happened to Chan. And oftentimes, they would disappear. The families couldn't find them. And so the genesis of it was from that. At the same time, I also wanted to kind of, you know, show different aspects of Chinatown that's very real and interesting and funny. And I knew a lot of these great people that worked around me, and basically they just played themselves. You know, like the guy who talked about, you know, the Chinese-American apple pie and things like that were just all stories that I've heard actually on and off during, you know, working in Chinatown.
Did you have some people play themselves in the movie?
Actually, a lot of them really did play themselves. The social worker played himself. The guy who was sort of researching Chinese culture actually played himself. Almost like 80% of those characters were all, you know, playing themselves.
The mother in your movie Dim Sum played herself also. What's the trick to writing a script for people who are basically playing themselves? Do you actually write lines for them?
Well, we write their own lines, actually. What we did on Dim Sum was actually interview the mother and the daughter together. And we asked them if this, in this kind of situation, what would the conversation be like? And they would tell us. We would record that, write that down, and then we would try to make it a little more dramatic or whatever, and then give back their own lines. I think that sort of a must in terms of working with non-professionals, because they can basically only pretty much play themselves. And in that case, you know, the mother was very good. I mean, she got her own lines, and often I go, oh, that's what I said last time. This is just how I would say it.
With the success of Chan is Missing, and it was really quite a critical success, and I think did quite well for a first film that cost $22,000.
Uh-huh.
Now, I would think that you would have gotten a lot of offers from, you know, from studios after that. Your next movie was Dim Sum, which also had a theme of generational differences in the Chinese-American community. Did you get offers to direct other people's scripts? And did you have to make, like, a big decision about whether to head in the area of your own interests or to just become, you know, a director who gets paid a lot more but doesn't have as much control over the stories they're telling?
Yeah, well, I did get a lot of offers to direct other people's scripts, but I felt at that time that I didn't want to fall into that trap, which is, oh, here I made one successful, really low-budget movie about something that I really knew, and all of a sudden I'm kind of a hired director in Hollywood. That would be a mistake. So I felt also at the same time, because Chan was kind of a more complex introductory look into Chinatown in a more general way, it's sort of like English 1A, I felt that I wanted to then do something that's very microscopic and very focused on just one family and three people. So that's sort of part of the logic that I had about it. And then after that, I felt that I wanted to just, then I could kind of give myself the license to learn something from working in the industry down in LA and do something not perhaps related to my own culture, and that's when I did Slam Dance.
Now, Slam Dance was a kind of new wave film noir in lots of color.
Right.
Tom Hulce starred in it. Was it important when you were directing this movie to make sure that you didn't put in Chinese-American actors and Chinese-American touches, you know, to like let the industry know that although you worked with Chinese-American themes, that you were capable of doing a film without those themes in it? Did you have to prove that?
Yeah, that's part of it. I think that's part of the reason why I did it. But at the same time, I think one of the philosophies we had in casting Slam Dance was that even sometimes they weren't written for ethnic roles, what we try to do was like cast Latinos, Blacks, and Asian. There was one Asian in it, so that there's sort of a picture that sort of makes it very, actually kind of reflects in reality what LA really is.
Mm-hmm.
So I did that, and I thought that that was kind of important. But pretty much I think Slam Dance was just done so that, you know, nobody can say, oh, this guy, you know, should and could only work with Chinese.
I see Slam Dance in a way as a film that allowed you to just really experiment with style also, since it wasn't the kind of emotional or family issues that you were dealing with. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Were you interested in taking all kinds of stylistic risks and seeing what they look like?
Yeah,
since it was
basically
more distant subject matter.
I thought that the script had certain problems, and I was sort of brought on as a director for hire, which I couldn't, you know, from scratch redo it. And then what sort of drove me to do the movie was basically sort of seeing that visual style, especially after kind of, you know, hiring two people who are really, really talented. Amir Mokri, who also shot Eat a Bowl of Tea with me, and this other Argentinian production designer, Eugenio Zanetti. And the three of us just really kind of, you know, did some really nice stuff visually with that movie.
Mm-hmm.
And yet still at the same time sort of making that work with the context of the story and the characters too.
Do you think you'll ever be able to make a big budget movie in America with an Asian American cast?
No. It's very difficult. I think unless it's like a really, really big, important, dramatic piece that involves the Americans, I think it's very, very difficult to make an all, you know, Chinese cast movie here.
And why?
Only because I think the mentality of the studios is that the minorities don't sell. It's very difficult to sell these kinds of movies. And I think, you know, it's not true, not totally true. I think movies like La Bamba, you know, Do the Right Thing, and Eat a Bowl of Tea in this case, I mean, they're very universal themes, and they're you know, what happens to these people are just as, you know, just the same as for any other culture, actually. But I think it's still a big risk for studios to do that kind of film.
Three of your films have been set in the Chinatown of the present or the recent past. How do you keep up with Chinatown now? You don't live there and you don't have a job there like like you once did.
I eat there a lot. which is true. I mean, for some reason, I sort of can't get away from Chinatown that way. I eat there a lot. And I still see an herbalist down there, so I kind of keep in touch that way. My herbalist sort of, you know, keeps me up on the local gossip. I have a lot of friends who sort of still, you know, live around there. And that's sort of, you know, what my contact is. I'd actually also read the Chinese newspaper in Chinatown quite a bit. So I try to keep in touch.
You know, you mentioned that you eat a lot in Chinatown. In at least two of your movies, there's a main character who either runs a restaurant or a club, and they have a very theatrical approach to it. And I was wondering if there was ever anyone in your family who did that.
I'm sure. There are a lot of members in my family that are like that, but also that's also pretty common within the Chinese. I mean, everything centers around eating. I mean, if you walk down the street, you see somebody and they greet you, they don't say hello, they say, have you eaten yet? So everything centers around food.
Wen Wang, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.